Welcome to The Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Matt.
Hey, Matt. So thanks for joining me. So Chris can't be here this week. So it's not a solo cast. It's a remote co-hosting cast. So
let's... Jeremy plus one.
Yes, right. Yes, our special guest, co-host Matt. So let's see. So, and this week on The Weekly, the death of the firstborn in Warhammer 40K, Paizo partners with Mirscape, the ARVTT, Cloudbreaker Alliance heads to Kickstarter, Candela Obscura has a theatrical release. So if it's not bad enough that Critical Role is playing Wembley, then yeah, theaters coming to a theater near you. And then Drive-Thru RPG bans AI content. So before we begin, let's check in on Brinkwatch. So this is day 188 of Kyle Brink's refusal to resign. So of course his statement to three black halflings was that people like him should leave the hobby as soon as possible, and he's not doing that. So let's encourage Kyle. Hashtag resign Kyle. Let's encourage him to put his money where his mouth is and honor his. His bullshit that he said on podcasts as he was trying to make excuses for that weird OGL that Wizards tried to get past us. All right. So starting with Games Workshop. So speaking of companies hiding and killing things, Games Workshop is finally retiring Space Marines. So I think it was 8th edition, as part of the lore, they revealed the Primaris Space Marines. So there was this secret gene seed that suddenly there are now super. So you have Space Marines, which are super soldiers. So these are super duper soldiers, I guess. So this super advanced, bigger, better version of Space Marines, which a lot of people thought was kind of a lore breaking. A lot of old school Warhammer players thought that was kind of a cop out. And it was, I think, Games Workshop's attempt to do a true scale Space Marine, because the older models, when you compare a Space Marine to just a typical regular infantry soldier, they're supposed to be like 12 feet tall, and the scale of the miniatures didn't reflect that. So Primaris scales them up and kind of gives you a more accurate representation of, compared to an unaugmented human, how big a Space Marine is supposed to be. So when they released that, people were very afraid this is what they're going to do. They're going to push out all the old models. They kept the old models available. They said they can play side by side, though they don't look very good. And then through 8th, 9th, and now we're in 10th edition, but through 8th and 9th, there was a weird size creep. There was power creep, but there was a weird size creep where the models were strangely getting taller and taller, even though they weren't being indicated as Primaris, but they started to scale up some of their new sculpts for Space Marines. And now they're finally saying, we're done. So they're stopping production of all of the old models. So all of the old scale models, and they're going to relegate a lot of these models to what they call the legends status. So they'll still have stat lines, and they'll still kind of somewhat maintain them, but they can only be played in friendly matches at home. No more tournaments. You know, maybe shops will, Warhammer shops will not be excited to have you bring them. Who knows what this is going to lead to, but you have a firstborn child, Matt. So if you had the choice to relegate your firstborn to the status of legends and basically put them in a closet and never get them out, do you think you would do that?
No, but I'm not a evil corporation.
Right. Yeah, so this is a move that people were kind of dreading, kind of expecting, and finally with 10th edition, they're doing it. And so what this does is it kind of changes the flexibility of – so to really make the – to give the individual models weapons and things, you have to buy multiple kits. So it's making you buy a lot more plastic to get the kind of loadout you want on your units, because they're – although they're not completely monoposed, the newer Primaris are a little bit more dynamically posed. So you can't just swap any arm and any torso and any head and any body. There's a lot of, you do have to do a lot of work to make it more. So they're making it less flexible. They're making it harder to hobby because they want you to just buy more kits. They don't want you to use existing kits or rework older ones. So that older kind of 90s style where there's just, you know, multiple arms, multiple legs, multiple heads, and then different, you know, weapons is not happening anymore. They get to choose, you know, what weapons come with what kits, and it's never enough. It's the I think they paid the guy that did the hot dog buns and hot dog packs, you know, there's like, you know, you get what, eight buns and or six buns and eight hot dogs, and you got to figure out how many you need to buy. They're doing right. that kind of thing where they're you never have enough, you know, flamers or you know, heavy bolters or whatever for your units, unless you buy multiple kits. So they say, you know, you can still proxy stuff, but that's not going to be probably socially acceptable for very long, or like tournament legal for very long. So things like the Thunderfire cannons, the Stalker tanks, land speeders have no Primaris equivalent, so they're just gone. And as of right now, there's no Servitors, no official models for Servitors. So even though those are in the rules officially, that you can't you can only use the old models. So yeah, it basically invalidates a lot of people. And obviously the move is, you haven't bought any new Space Marines from us for, you know, half a decade now, so we're going to force you to buy new models at our amazing prices.
So the way it's going, like 10 years from now, their game will just be based on 40K action figures, it sounds like.
Yeah, because you can't. Right.
You can't customize them, so they'll be like these weird unpainted action figures because they still want to sell you their paint.
Right. Yeah, they're stupid. Yeah. It's a strange thing, and it seems like they don't really. They're just, you know, they've got their market strategy and their you know, the profit that they're aiming at, and they're not really concerned with what the players. Because I think they just assume you're addicted. You're in it, so we can do whatever we want, and we're going to piss some people off, but it's never going to be enough to really affect our bottom line. And that holds true because Games Workshop has the biggest year ever. So they reported their revenue, and they're up from 2022. They're up 15%, 15.2% retail. Their operating profits, 8.2%. Earnings per share, up 4.6%. So it's just – it's all coming up roses, and they had a financial statement and a lot of the typical corporate bullshit. They said things like the reason Games Workshop is great is that it is run with principles and has a culture and values, which when applied by good people who align to these principles and behaviors can deliver great performance. That sounds like that creepy, the CEO of BlackRock. That sounds like that weird statement that he made about, ESG scores, and we must align this thinking. Make them think the thinking. Yeah.
Do you have the from that article about their profits? Do you have their net profit? I forgot how much it was.
Oh, the they're kind of what they were making operating wise. Let me see if that's in here.
It was in there somewhere.
Yeah, they
it was like the revenue after costs or whatever.
Yes. Where did it go? I've got subscriber numbers. I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing. Oh, there we go. Their cash flow. So they have a 136.5 million pounds. Return. So yeah, the profits are pretty big. So, yeah,
there was another article. I didn't share it with you. You might have saw it. Oh, someone was talking about how they spend like $8 million a year on their molds.
Oh yeah, yeah, I saw that.
But and that sounds like a lot of money. But if you're making like 136 million pounds, is probably what, like $150 million right now or something like that. So 8 million as part of your cost of operating is not really that big a deal.
Right.
And now you're going to charge more because your miniatures keep growing.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's amazing. It's kind of like the Starbucks model. You know, they sell you like, you know, 20 cents a coffee for $5, you know. They have to, you know, they have to buy the machines to make the coffee, but, you know, basically once they get it into production, so once they've, you know, tooled these molds and are running these injection process is creating this plastic, they're selling you 10 cents worth of plastic for, you know, 10 pounds or, you know, $10. So it's probably more than that, probably $20. So it's, yeah, it's really ridiculous. And they even, there was a former employee that was on a podcast recently that was saying that actually the, them setting up their little, their paint factory and this contrast paint thing that they did saved the company, because they were in another one of those situations where they had invested a lot in stuff that wasn't returning profits, probably like, you know, tooling for new miniatures for these starter sets, because they're on this like weird treadmill of like every 3 years they're doing a new addition for each of these games. And so now they have two, you know, they have, you know, they're two games that they're pushing, Age of Sigmar and Warhammer 40K, and they just keep, you know, over investing in it and then not getting people excited enough to actually buy these like big starter sets. So those keep piling up. So for the previous edition of Age of Sigmar, they were way, those went into like overstock and were being sold online for, you know, a quarter of their value, or a quarter of their MSRP. So yeah, they're, but they figured something out. They figured out how to keep doing this. They make good miniatures. The quality of their you know, miniatures is great. It's a very specific style, though. And I think now that we have a bigger range of creators doing 3D sculpting for miniatures, we're seeing a bigger variety of styles. So it may lead people to look in other places eventually, because Games Workshop definitely has a very specific look for a lot of their miniatures. And it's so yeah, if you're looking for a variety, you're not going to find it from them. They're basically a one, even both their fantasy and sci-fi look very similar, but they're also talking about, yeah.
I was thinking that maybe making the Marines bigger was sort of a physical version of how they changed the name of the Imperial Guard. Like, so that they could say this is ours and nobody else's kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know? That could be possible. Yeah, they're working very hard to be distinct enough that they can, you know, trademark things and they can defend their IP as much as possible. And that also comes with how heavily they're leaning into licensing. So licensing, I mean, we've seen this, so much merchandise. There are, like you were saying, action figures. There literally are now Warhammer action figures. So if you want to pay $40 per action figure, you could literally do a whole army on the tabletop in a, you know, kind of Star Wars like 5.5-inch scale action figure, or like 4 3/4. But so they're doing tons of merchandise and they're doing tons of licensing for games. So there's a lot of mobile games and PC games and console games out with the Warhammer IP. So yeah. We'll see. But some other interesting stuff that was in that report. So 78% of their sales come from outside the UK. And that's why they give the UK that sweetheart deal. The prices, if you can get stuff out of the UK, the price that you're paying is so much lower than anywhere else in the world. It's ridiculous. They really? The local pricing in pounds is so sweet compared to what they make everybody else pay. And when the British pound is weak, it's insanely cheap compared to other markets. But they've got two main factories. This is all in Nottingham, England. Ooh. They have two main factories, a paint factory, two warehouse facilities, design studios, and back office support functions. So a lot of stuff going on in not a big town. But
I've been listening to that audiobook of the Designers and Dragons.
Oh, mm-hmm.
and it's got me a little hypersensitive, because it seems like every other game company they cover turns into an evil company, you know?
right.
And the Games Workshop one is interesting, because they talked about how they studied the orders coming from game stores in UK, mm-hmm. and using the sales figures from that, they opened Games Workshop stores in those areas and basically drove those stores out of business. Then they tried to do that in the US and they got sued for it, because our laws, I guess, are a little more strict.
Yeah.
Which always surprised me when we have a stricter law than they do in Europe. But, Yeah, just
that really sucks. Yeah, and but it does seem like they're trying to do that now with their web store. So they're not going to, maybe especially in America, they're not going to be able to get away with crowding out the friendly local game stores and eating their business away. But it seems like they're really trying to do that with their online online sales, because that, you know, they offer bonuses and you get it first if you order online, and when there's big releases, how they decide to divvy it up between the stores. Always, you can get it if you order it online from them, but if you're waiting at your local game store, it may not come, and they may just they may just short the store. So if you've pre-ordered, you don't get it. So they're really playing hardball with, I think, a lot of the brick and mortar retailers that aren't Games Workshop, so that aren't Warhammer stores. So that really sucks. So that principle and culture, it just means fucking over the independent sellers, independent retailers. Yeah. So that's
and
not
the gamers.
Yeah, and the gamers too. Yeah, and the gamers. I mean, because if you don't have a Warhammer store, the center of, and probably where you're going to play, where you're going to meet, where you learn the game, is going to be that local hobby shop. And if they're going to screw them over, then yeah, they're just going to move away from your products. Yeah, the other thing that was interesting is so their web stores have almost 427,000 active users, so active accounts that buy from them, and so that's pretty huge number of customers that they can rely on for pre-orders and stuff. But the thing that was surprising is their Warhammer Plus, their subscription service, which is a ghost town, only has 136,000 subscribers. So they're not doing huge numbers at all. You'd think that those numbers would be a little bit closer. The people that bought from them and the people that would be interested in, their streaming content would be a little bit closer. It's up from last year, but still, these are pretty weak numbers for probably what the operating costs of that platform are, because they're paying for bandwidth and production. They set up, studios and things to produce all of their battle reports and stuff. So, yes. So no more, and they actually said this in the report, no more 50% plus year over year growth. It's like they were expecting that. That's so funny. Yeah. Well, we can't expect that anymore. Gosh, golly gee. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, $8.6 million in just the tooling costs on molds last year. But then when you look at what they made on those miniatures that they cast with those molds, it's just silly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so no more Firstborn or your Firstborn are relegated. But there are things like one page rules. There's a lot of other game systems that you can use those miniatures for, and they're gonna.
Oh, yeah.
I think they're gonna realize that. So I'm just wondering how long, because this is not a sustainable model to keep screwing the customers and keep trying to take things away from them that they've played with for decades. So eventually people are just going to get pissed off enough that they're going to look at other rule sets, they're going to look at other miniatures producers, and even if they have some of the best miniatures in the market, people will go with second best if they can be more comfortable with how the company's operating and how they're being treated as a customer. So we'll see.
And they'll just, once it starts taking a serious downturn, mm-hmm. I know what they're going to do. They'll just blow it all up, and mm-hmm. they'll bring in Age of the Emperor, right?
Right.
Change the style of things mm-hmm. and just ride the word of mouth, the free advertising from word of mouth from making such a drastic change.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like they did before.
Right.
With fantasy.
With the old world. Right, yeah, the death of Superman, right? Yeah, anytime they need some attention, they'll kill their, mm-hmm. they'll pretend to kill their IP. And then they'll bring it back. Like, they're bringing back the old world. Like, they're going to bring that back as a, mm-hmm. Whatever.
But as a like a premium product,
yes,
right?
Right, like, yeah. So it's going to be like Horus Heresy. It's going to come back, and you're going to have to pay triple the price because they're just going to do resin models and, yeah.
Triple the Games Workshop price, which is ridiculous already.
Yes. Yeah, so it's fun. All right, well, let's talk about a company that may be making better decisions, or I'm not quite sure yet. This doesn't sound all that promising. But Paizo has just announced that they are partnering with Mirrorscape. So we talked about Mirrorscape before. They're a a company that's leaning heavily into devices, so tablets and phones, to run an augmented reality virtual tabletop for RPGs. So they have some real world producers that they're licensing the, you know, what they produce physical assets like Dwarven Forge and some of these companies. They're going to produce digital versions of those officially licensed to be included in the Mirrorscape platform. And now they're partnering with Paizo to offer both Pathfinder and Starfinder official assets in the game. So you'll have authentic three-dimensional assets for this augmented reality setting. So Mirrorscape, they had a Kickstarter, I think, a year or two ago, and they have officially launched on this past July 25th. They launched the platform, and they're doing kind of a nice thing to be able to try it. They're letting you sign up for a 30-day trial, and everybody can sign up for this, and they give you the entire store for free, like everything that's offered, all of their assets for free, and let you play with that for a month. And then after the trial expires, then you can decide, you know, what you want to buy, what you want to use. And regardless of that, you'll get a free starter set, which you get to keep, that will include enough, you know, three-dimensional terrain pieces to build caverns and dungeons, along with 10 free miniatures. So that's all yours. And but the full store with all of the pre-built maps and everything that are going to be offered will, of course, expire with your trial. And you, of course, and then you can go back and buy them from the shop if it was something that you liked and were using it. So they've already partnered with Dwarven Forge, Fat Dragon Games, Hero Forge, Reaper Minis, and Norse Foundry. So basically creating what they call digital twins of all of these real world models. And they also said because they're working with Paizo that they are fully committed and will support the ORC, the Open RPG Creative License. So everything is going to be compatible with that as well. The one thing that doesn't sound too encouraging, though, is they're kind of leaning heavy into, we started with mobile devices, but we really want to be on AR glasses and headsets, like the one that Apple is releasing for $3,500. So if the buy-in to play this on this platform is $3,500, I don't know how many people are actually going to be using it. If that's their ideal.
I think it's cool that Pathfinder is trying to find a place in the light of this, you know, impending Wizards of the Coast walled garden thing that's coming down the pike. But my opinion on that particular service hasn't really changed. I don't see the value. Like, I'm into VTTs now. Like, I've learned to appreciate them playing with you and Will. But it's because you and I live thousands of miles apart.
Right.
That's like literally the only reason I appreciate it. Like,
right.
I would never choose to use a VTT with people that I could drive to their house. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly.
And the added thing, which we talked about last time we talked about these guys, was of using AR at the table. I just I don't see the value in it at all. I don't.
Just staring through an iPad camera. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and those Apple glasses are not. I mean, the reason those are so expensive, because that was literally just they wanted to get them in the hands of developers. Mm-hmm. They didn't. It wasn't really meant for the public, although they sold them to you if you were willing to pay that price.
Right, right.
You know, so it's going to be years before those are really back around to it, you know, where people are thinking about buying them and they're a decent price. Mm-hmm. So
Yeah, so
best of luck.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's a ways off, and I don't think VR and even AR are going to have a huge impact on what we're doing for quite a while. Yeah, they're saying ultimately where they want to be is things like hand tracking and gesture control in their platform, so you can, you know, move your hand around and it will affect things as your kind of interface with the AR platform. But yeah, who knows? But yeah, if you're curious about what Mirrorscape is doing. It's already available on the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store as of this past July 25th. So take a look and see what kind of Pathfinder, Starfinder stuff is in there. And yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it could be interesting for our streaming, you know, if it's easy to use and visually a little bit more interesting, it has lighting and stuff and we can kind of move cameras around. That would be kind of cool to choreograph stuff visually a little bit more. But as far as like having a device on the table, I don't see that as at the table. I don't see that as very useful.
Yeah. And the problem now is there's so many VTTs either operating now or coming out soon. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, obviously I'm you and I kickstarted Alchemy, right?
Right.
And, before that, we were trying Roll. Mm-hmm. And you've got Foundry. Right. And we were doing Astral.
Right. And Owlbear Rodeo. Know, yeah.
And Owlbear Rodeo. That's right. I forgot about that one. And it's like, and there's still more coming out. Like, yes. They're still jumping into like my Instagram algorithm as advertisements for new ones coming.
Hmm.
And I'm like, how is this? Like, there's too many. It's too many.
right. Yeah, and the market's going to thin. And so it really sucks if you support one, if you kind of make your choice and say, this is the one we're going to use, and you get your whole group involved, you know, everybody buys in, or at least downloads it or logs in, makes an account, and then they just suddenly disappear, you know? So everything that you've saved, all that you've been building in that platform, just like what we did with Astral, like all that time I spent putting those Blade Runner assets into Astral, it was just deleted. They just turned it off, you know? So that can happen at any time. So yeah, when the shakeup comes, when Wizards finally releases their platform, I think it's going to be lean times for some of these, you know, the lesser performing platforms. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
It is an interesting short-term revenue boost, I think, for some of these game companies, because pretty much all the ones coming out now are emphasizing that they've got licensed product from, you know, known game companies. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of these game companies are seeing these short-term revenue boosts of like, oh, now this VTT wants to use our stuff and this VTT wants to use our stuff. But then when they start dying, that's all going to go away.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, but you're right. That's bringing revenue into some of the publishers that we like, and hopefully letting them get bigger and better in the games they're making. So yeah, that's good. Mm. And speaking of games that people are making, we have Cloudbreaker Alliance, so a unique tabletop headed to Kickstarter that's inspired by, now this list is kind of weird to parse, but inspired by Star Trek, Final Fantasy, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, and Discworld. So I'm trying to put all that together in my head, like how that would actually look and feel.
So it's a turtle-shaped spaceship.
Right. On a 5-year mission.
With a big sword.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. No.
Yeah, it's a funny combination. But so this game was created by CJ Leung. So CJ Leung has a award-winning YouTube channel called Don't Stop Thinking. And when I went to look at the channel, I found that I was already subscribed. So I've been to his channel before, and he does really good tutorials for like learning a game you've never played. So he goes through like Call of Cthulhu and, you know, some systems, and really breaks things down in a really nice way to understand them. And the thing that I like the best about his channel is, from his name, I'm guessing he's Asian. Or, you know, at least partly Asian on mother or father's side, but his accent sounds like it's by way of Eastern Europe. So it's kind of like a Chinese accent that's filtered through Romania. And so I love the sound of his voice is very unexpected, but it's very fun to listen to for a tutorial. And he explains things very well. He breaks things down very well. So this is his baby. So his latest project is a tabletop game called Cloudbreaker Alliance. So Cloudbreaker Alliance is headed to Kickstarter on August 1st. And so it's obviously anime inspired. There's a couple of anime influences, but it's also, so it's both Eastern and Western media are inspiring this. And maybe like CJ himself, maybe a mixture of cultures. And he seems to be kind of bringing those things together. So what happens is the players assume the roles of cloudbreakers. So cloudbreakers are tasked with breaking through these ominous cloud walls that have kind of divided civilizations. So it's a game of discovery. So I think that's where kind of the Star Trek comes into it, is you're breaking through these barriers in this world and discovering new cultures, new civilizations, and that's your role as a player. And it sounds like very much a mashup of fantasy tropes, both Eastern and Western. So some of the possibilities they talk about are cowboy orcs wielding Kai blasters or samurai angels transforming into magical girls. And they stress a modular approach to combat abilities. So they separate class and equipment, and you can use that. You can use kind of lean into either your class and your skills or your equipment to give you benefits in combat. And they don't want to your character to feel compromised in combat effectiveness. So they let equipment and class kind of be equally as important. So there are 256 levels of character growth, they're calling it. So you can level up to 256 if you need to. That sounds very Final Fantasy, across 32 classes. And the classes have unique features where you can have two active classes at any time, giving you this like really high level of combination. So like, I guess everything is, you're all basically dual classing, and you have this like myriad of class combinations to give you just the right mix of, you know, whatever type of skills or whatever kind of play style that you want. The other thing that feels very kind of Final Fantasy inspired is the spirit token system. So these are tokens that are generated during battle, and you can, you know, kind of save them up to unleash very potent abilities from the character called Spirit Bursts. So that's a very that feels very Final Fantasy, kind of like filling up your meter to use your you know, super attack. And the thing that you can do though is also share these tokens with your party. So if someone is closer to breaking out their super breaker buster sword ability, then you can share your tokens and let them pull that off. So it sounds interesting. It sounds like an interesting combination. And, you know, this designer has a lot of experience with existing games, existing systems out there. So probably kind of a greatest hits and all of the inspiration of his, you know, kind of pop culture, his dream pop culture mashup. So interesting.
Does it say what the like kind of core mechanic is? Like,
yes,
how the resolution is?
It's going to be a pair of D6s. So two six-sided dice will be so tokens and D6s is all you're going to need to play. Basically it is a target number, and you're rolling the D6s plus your ability to hit a target. And I think I forget what the kind of default skill test is, if it's like a 7 or whatever. But they don't talk about Powered by the Apocalypse, like successes with conditions or anything. They just talk about like straight success or failure in the mechanics. But it is 2d6.
That's very like old school traveler system.
Yeah. It's interesting. And the other thing that they mention is they're going to also produce a monster conversion chart for all 5e monsters. So they want you to take, if this is, you know, maybe good for trying to get people coming from 5e to try something different. They're going to have all of the probably the whole monster manual for 5e all statted out, or at least convertible into the system. So basically all your fantasy monsters can make an appearance.
I hear lawyers sharpening pens. I don't know.
Right. And they're calling it the setting is a counter-apocalyptic setting. So, you know, having a world that's divided by clouds, that these barriers need to be broken, means you're, you know, discovering diverse civilizations. You're not looting and plundering, and it's not like digging through the wreckage of a destroyed world. It's actually discovering new worlds that have been isolated communities, and, you know, communicating and connecting with them. So I think that eliminates some people's, you know, kind of frustration or whatever with the going to people's house, stab them with a dagger and take their stuff, you know, kind of aesthetic of fantasy role play.
You could still do that.
Yeah, you could still do that, though. You're just breaking through clouds. Before you stab them, you gotta get through the clouds. Yeah, so
that's a cool idea, though. I mean, it sounds kind of like an exploration game, you know, which, you know, obviously the old school is the hex crawl. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that always kind of bugged me about hex crawls generally was like, you would have this big ass map that was already known to the players, but somehow magically they were exploring it, you know? And this is a way to solve that. It's like, well, there's these clouds that obscure things. I like that. That's cool.
Yeah. That's right. Cause it gives you barriers on the world that, can limit the players. Instead of mountain ranges, you can have clouds. But the other thing that they talk about, so the collaborative storytelling, so, you know, they have the modular game combat, but also, you know, they're focusing on collaborative storytelling. And the influence for that is what they're calling the Kishoten Ketsu, which is the four-part story structure that's popular in a lot of Asian storytelling. So if you've ever seen a comic strip, the vertical comic strips in Japan, the Yonkoma comics, there's a very kind of old traditional story structure that is that's based in four parts. So the Western kind of three-part structure is, you know, setup, confrontation, resolution, whereas the Eastern structure has an additional part in there, which is a twist before the confrontation. So they're trying to include that idea, which is also very common in anime storytelling, I think. They're trying to include that in a lot of the story structure or the adventures for this to give it more of that Asian flavor. So that twist, that twist or something that happens right before kind of the resolution of the story is included in the thinking of this game. So there's videos that CJ Leung has already put on the Don't Stop Thinking YouTube channel. I'll put a link to his channel, and you can take a look at kind of the videos to introduce the setting and the mechanics and everything. So it's very anime. The look of the game, I think the art style and everything is going to be very anime, very magical girl, very bright and cute, but very fantastic. So if that's not your flavor, if that's not your style, you know, That's something. That's something. It made a kind of a deliberate choice to go very, very anime in the look. But the system sounds interesting. It sounds like a fun setting, and anti apocalypse is interesting. Counter apocalyptic. So this is coming to Kickstarter on August 1st. So just a few days, you can take a look at the campaign, and joining Leung on the design is the Avatar Legends co-designer Daniel Kwan and Fallout RPG editor Jackie Leung. So yeah, so it's a very Asian-based design group. And plus the Japanese artist. Oh, so this is where the anime look comes from. Sunohara and Hagaki with a one are Japanese artists that are doing the illustration and character design. So that's why, that's why it looks so Japanese, is because it's Japanese artists. So yeah, so take a look.
Yeah, it sounds cool. I mean, it sounds like the kind of game I would like to play, but maybe not be the one running.
Right. Yeah, somebody with a passion for anime would be a good choice. But interesting. I mean, and I think we're going to see more and more of this, game systems that have a setting that's a new take on fantasy. Yeah, and I think using that Eastern influence, and it's Eastern influence that's not kind of fetishized. You know, these are Asian creators doing a game that's East versus West, and probably a lot of them themselves are a mixture of East versus West. They may be, you know, Canadian born, American born, you know, European born, Asian. So they have an interesting cultural mix, and they can bring that to this design. So yeah, probably worth checking out if that appeals to you. And you always wanted to play Final Fantasy Star Trek, and who hasn't in Discworld?
Yeah, the Star Trek part of that, you know, I think they're stretching a little bit.
Right.
Everything you just said is not really Star Trek. But that's cool.
I like saving up my my tokens to unleash my phaser, my super phaser ability.
Right.
All right. So, we talked a little bit about last week the so Critical Role kind of deleting one of their former hosts, and also their appearance, I think, in October and at Wembley. So there will be the reunion of the Mighty Nein will happen live on stage where the Beatles and Led Zeppelin performed. which doesn't make any sense at all. So making
Nothing matters anymore.
So making even more, making even less sense and sounding more ridiculous is Candela Obscura's second chapter is going to be screened in movie theaters as a 5-hour cinema premiere. And yes, that's 5 hours of actual play sitting in a cinema. Wow. So what is Candela Obscura? So they've already premiered their first season, or their first chapter, I think they're calling it. So it's an alternative universe of the 1920s, kind of an offshoot from Critical Role. They're using their own original system that's basically Blades in the Dark, their take on Blades in the Dark. This second chapter is actually going to be a completely new story. It may eventually end up linking back to the first chapter, but they're going to have all new players, all new characters, and a new host. So this second chapter will feature Marisha Ray and Brennan Lee Mulligan, who are names that critters might know. So at San Diego Comic-Con, they announced this, and they're bringing on other players that will comprise the Circle of Needle and Thread. So this, the name of that secret society. So they'll be paranormal investigators protecting people and the society from the threat of paranormal, dangerous magic and weirdness. So yeah. So the first chapter was game mastered by Matt Mercer. This one will be actually run by the designer of this original system. So Spencer Stark, the lead designer of Candela Obscura, will be the facilitator in this second chapter. So, yeah, that will be interesting, I guess. So they'll play this out over 3 episodes, and it's going to be live streamed, so you can watch it, you know, watch it from home. But if you want the event, if you want to cosplay and you want to throw things at the screen, August 31st, Cinemark will be screening all 5 hours of this opening chapter in theaters throughout the U.S. So concurrent with the live streams, they will be projecting this. I guess, you know, that's the digital projectors allow you to do this, right? You can just, you know, stream the internet. Yeah. Yeah. So that's changed things a lot.
Wow. So how much would I piss off the Critical Role fans if I went to that and started throwing toast at the screen?
Yes, exactly. You got to come up with the spoons and toast, and yeah, you got to come up with a whole ritual for what you do during these theatrical presentations. Yeah, I don't know. 5 hours sounds pretty brutal. There's going to be a lot of walking around, a lot of checking your phone and stuff. I don't think they can actually hold an audience for 5 hours straight.
Yeah, that's rough. I wouldn't watch a Scorsese film that was 5 hours.
Yeah, right. I watched 4.5. The Irishman, I think, was was over 4.
Take a break. I had to take a break.
Yeah, so you said that you've seen kind of a simulcast stream of a Riff Tracks live event. Mm-hmm. But they keep those to about 2 hours, right? Like the runtime of a movie?
Yeah. It's usually like they'll come in, do a little talk with the audience because they do it at a live theater in Nashville.
Oh, okay.
And then they'll have like one of their shorts they'll do, and then they'll do the main movie. But those are always, you know, old movies that are heavily edited, so they're never more like hour and a half tops, probably less.
Right.
So yeah, it's about a 2-hour experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So 5 hours is a pretty big ask. What are the ticket prices like? Are they like movie ticket prices or theater ticket prices for something like this?
The Fandango tickets, I think, were like $18.
Oh, okay. So it's not insane. Yeah, that's good. Yes,
it's not bad.
Yeah, so I wonder, for 5 hours, they're giving you 5 hours, though, of amazing role play. So I wonder what those
charge more just because the theater's going to want that space, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because they'll be taking up a screen. Yeah, that could be showing, you know, whatever, Barbie. So yeah, that's true. So I wonder. And I wonder if that's I guess the, you know, kind of IRL meetups of fans of online things, you know, could be a little fun, but it just depends on where you're doing it.
Yeah, I'll probably watch, not in a theater, but I'll probably watch. I'll try to watch the first episode of the new season, like I tried to watch the first episode of the last season, and made it like halfway through, just because it's a new it's a new game master, a new cast, so I'm going to give them a second chance, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah.
What I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah, the first one, the first chapter wasn't great. I think just our campaign of Vaesen was much more interesting, and the characters did a lot more, and the you guys engaged with the world a lot more than I think they did at all. It was yeah, it wasn't great, and I didn't like the system didn't run all that well. It's a very simple system, but they were just saying numbers and things out loud too much. That kind of like was a little bit weird and disruptive. I got a six. I got a six. You know, it's like that doesn't make an interesting actual play.
Yeah, and the players were struggling in the part I watched. Mm-hmm. Were struggling to assign the points to the correct places and. It's like a simple system, but it's also seems like it has unnecessary pools or something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're right.
I wasn't too into the system.
Right. Yeah, so we'll see. I can't believe this business they've got going now, though. This touring live show thing. I mean, I guess they figured out, like, you know, just like the recording industry figured out, that's where the money is. You know, you can stream it for free. You can, you know, let them enjoy that. But live events, you're going to get tickets. You're going to get box office. You're going to get, you know, butts in seats. So they figured that out. So, yeah, if this turns into, like, you know, multi-million dollar events, that's going to be insane. I mean, actual play that people are treating like a performance, you know, on the scale of a Lady Gaga concert or whatever, whoever the kids go to see nowadays. That's crazy. Very interesting. Well, let's end this with some good news. So we have an announcement from Drive-Thru RPG. So they are banning all primarily written by AI content. So last week, One Bookshelf, the operators of Drive-Thru RPG, updated their AI-generated content policy, and they're banning all content that is preliminarily written by AI. And I think they're probably experiencing what the Kindle, you know, Amazon Kindle, and a lot of the digital bookstores experienced right after the release of ChatGPT, is that people just started mass generating AI-written novels and just posting them as this, like, you know, just this completely insane, you know, try to cash grab and try to trick people into buying things just based on a, just based on a blurb that they're going to get for an ebook. And probably, you know, there's a lot of 99-cent ebooks out there. But I heard that, a lot of the ebook platforms were just flooded with thousands and thousands of submissions after that happened. Mm-hmm. So the same thing has probably happened with Drive-Thru RPG. There's just a lot of people that are trying to take advantage of this easy text generation. And it's funny, the timing is interesting because, you know, right now we've got the WGA and SAG-AFTRA striking, and one of their big things is, you know, is AI's influence on art. You know, for the writers, the AI generation is worrisome, and then for actors, the digital image, you know, recreating their digital image is becoming an issue. So
literally, like, sorry to interrupt.
No.
The one that got me was the streamers and film production companies wanted to do full body scans of actors, pay them a one-time fee, and have the rights to that image in perpetuity.
Yes. Right.
With no like residuals or anything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh my God, that is so dystopian and terrible.
There was one production they specifically talked about. The actors were just called in one day. You get paid for a day of work, and all you do is sit in front of all these cameras while we scan you, but then the asset we're creating, we own you forever. And they said, of course, you know, somebody with a big name and a big powerful agent behind them is going to be able to, you know, negotiate out of that. But the thing that it's really going to hurt is the background performers. So basically, you worked as an extra. You'll never work as an extra again because they have you. You're going to appear in movies. You're going to be sitting at the bar in the background of every Tom Cruise movie, but you'll never be paid again because they own your scan.
Yeah.
Yeah, so ridiculous. So this is all starting July 31st is when this comes into effect. So that means, yeah, primarily written by AI language generators will no be works will no be no longer be allowed on the site. And they're talking about, though, you know, we still don't have great detection tools for this. So of course, you know, they're going to say this will be the rules, but it's going to be hard to, you know, kind of drive out all of the people trying to sneak this past the system. And they also are talking about AI-generated art images. So they're making a point of saying that, so this policy also applies to AI-generated art, and that you're basically going to have to say specifically that this that is what you used. So and the problem with this, if you don't know, is that these artificial intelligence algorithms were trained on the data set is trained on techniques of pre-existing data sets that they don't own, you know, that they just acquired images that were, you know, available online. So they're stealing people's work and basically turning it into something that can be reproduced with their software. So statement from DriveThru, at this time, DriveThru Marketplace requires partners to set up their own AI-generated artwork policies on game, rulebooks, and adventure products. Any products that utilize AI-generated art must be tagged as such. At this time, the marketplace does not accept standalone artwork products that utilize AI-generated art. So the updates for the 19th, this came out on the 19th. We value innovation, but starting on July 31st, Roll20 and the DriveThru Marketplace will not accept commercial content primarily written by AI language generators. We acknowledge enforcement challenges and trust in the goodwill of our partners to offer customers unique works based primarily on human creativity. And with our AI-generated art policy, community content program policies, they are dictated by the publishers that owns that. So yeah, you're the publisher that owns things are allowed to decide what they want to put out there, but it's going to affect, yeah, if it can be posted or not. So yeah, unfortunately, they're going to have to rely on goodwill, so people not you know, cheating to get this stuff out there. And but it's good news. It's good news for creatives. I think unfortunately, game designers sometimes tend to be a little bit on the cheap side, and they want to get their game out there and they want it to look good, but they don't want to pay an artist. So yeah, that can easily be a problem, especially with the AI art generation. I heard a couple of people that have published things say, wow, this is going to make my games look so much better. And it's like, okay. And it is very recognizable. I don't think I've seen a piece of AI art that I was like, oh, wow, that's that artist, that's an amazing technique from that artist. They're still recognizably Frankensteined enough that you can tell it's not, like, a human wouldn't have done that. And I'm sure it'll get better and better, but the fact that people, you know, people don't have the eye or the discretion for that, and they just want to throw that, you know, throw that all over their work is pretty depressing.
Well, some of them are going to be real obvious too. Like, you know, when you put up your your $1.99 drive-through PDF, mm-hmm. and it has this art that's like this amazing Blanchian,
right.
You know, like intricate, you know, abstract craziness. You're like, $1.99, huh?
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because they'll definitely make that mistake because they didn't pay anything for it. So I think, like, I hope the thinking eventually gets to the point where, okay, AI generation, there's no stopping it. It's going to exist, but we have to acknowledge stuff that's generated by AI, and it has no copyright. It has no value because no human labor went into it. You know, writing a text prompt is not labor. You know, the software did the labor. So that's fine. Do all of that you want. Pollute the internet, cover the world with that stuff. And, you know, people have done, using those tools, done some interesting, you know, experiments and some funny things, like kind of testing the limits of those tools. But we have to recognize that you don't own that. Nobody owns that. So if you're going to waste your time producing that stuff, it has no value and you should receive no revenue from it. You know, it should be impossible to sell because it contains no labor. So yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. And unfortunately, I think I heard just recently that OpenAI, the company responsible for ChatGPT, has kind of quietly retired their AI detection tools. So they were working on those and, you know, acknowledging that you need to be able to find out if, you know, their software was used. But now they're quietly saying, well, maybe you don't need to. Maybe we're not going to do that anymore. Wow. Yeah, so I don't trust much of what's going on with this. But it's good. It's good that DriveThru is kind of taking this stance.
Yeah, it is really good that they're making that stand. Mm-hmm, like you said, it's going to be hard to catch it all. Mm-hmm. But if they have this rule in place and then their community reports to them, it'll, you know, they can be like, oh, well, you know, you violated our standards. We're yanking your title.
Yes, yes.
You know, so it does give them a way to take action, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, we said that this is our policy, so you're out of here.
Yeah,
That's good.
No, I think that is good. Yeah, if they have that, if there is a written policy, then they can, you know, use that to enforce things. And I think you're right, the community will also help find those things. That was a funny thing that happened in Japan. Any of the studios, the Japanese manga studios producing comics, whenever an artist traced a Google image, they were always caught. So the readers, the readers of manga in Japan, like, look at the background and look at the buildings in every single panel of these comics. And if they see anything, they'll Google search, you know, skyscraper or chicken or whatever, and they'll say, it's within the first page of results, and you trace this photo, you know, for your manga. So there have been tracing scandals in Japan. So hopefully there'll be a few people that decide they are going to be the enforcers of this, and they'll track down all, you know, AI, misrepresented AI generated work and call it out. But yeah, so hopefully the internet will have a little bit of its own policing.
Yeah, it's a little scary. Like forgery is, and plagiarism have always been a thing. Mm-hmm. But to a certain degree, art forgery, visual art forgery, in a weird way, takes skill. I can remember, this is going weird, but when I was a kid, well, middle school, I had like the Empire Strikes Back, like, official movie magazine, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was this great painting in there of, and it's the Hoth, Battle of Hoth, and like Luke is on the ground in his flight suit looking up at this big AT-AT, you know? Mm-hmm. And I had a Traveler supplement, and one of the full page art pieces in it, you could hold them up next to each other and see, oh, they just drew over everything,
right?
Changed how his helmet looked and took the AT-AT out of the background.
Wow.
You know?
Right, right.
And I remember being, holy shit, they just copied this, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But now it's super scary because now you don't even have to be, you know, a semi-decent line drawer. You just have this machine do this crap for you, you know?
And right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then people can just, you know, plead ignorance, you know, it's just like, oh, I had no idea I was stealing. I was just, you know, using this, you know, commercially advertised software. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think, especially for the art asset generation, I think it's important. I think it's something that Midjourney is doing. So when you generate stuff, you're generating it basically onto a Discord server or their website. So you're publicly generating all your art. So anything you make with your genius text prompts, other people can use. Like it's out there forever. It's not like something that you created that you have any rights to. You can use the software, but it's publicly posted, so anybody can copy and paste that and put that in there, whatever thing they're doing. So I think that's a good way also to prevent people from thinking they have any ownership over these images that are being generated. But yeah, it's too late now. I mean, they needed just like, you know, private data, you know, privacy policies and personal data. They needed to stop this a long time ago. It's already too late. It's, you know, it's already a free for all. So of course, everyone that's posted artwork on the internet is having it included in a data set, whether they like it or not.
That feature, mm-hmm. the fact that anyone can use it, as long as that stays true, it'll probably be the only thing that keeps, like, for instance, Wizards of the Coast. Like, if they could AI generate their art but still maintain a copyright on it, they would have a whole set of AI generated magic cards.
Oh yeah, that's true.
They would just start cranking them out.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I was really sad to see the new Secret Invasion, the new Marvel Disney series on their Disney Plus platform. Their whole opening sequence was AI generated art. It was all this like weird animation that looked like, you know, kind of paint on glass, like digital paint on glass, and it was like these, you know, characters morphing between, you know, human and Skrull. But it was obviously like, just because of the likenesses of the actors on the show, you could tell this is just weird AI generated art that is like, you know, grab some runway photos or, you know, some red carpet photos and just, you know, thrown their images in there. It was really depressing. So Disney has already made had the poor taste of using AI art for a show opener. So we'll see where that goes. But good for you, DriveThru RPG. Hopefully, yeah. And it's the biggest platform, you know, out there. So hopefully they hang in there and keep making good decisions. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week. So, hey, Matt, where can people find you?
I closed my Twitter X, dead bird, whatever you call it, site. I closed my account. Finally, I was, once the X thing, I was already limping along with that site anyway, but now this whole X ridiculousness, I'm like, nah, that's it. That's enough. Right. So I'm on Threads, on Threads and Instagram, same username at Hargold, HARGALD. So you can drop by there. I'll be on here tomorrow night live streaming with Jeremy.
Yes.
Got my new Session Zero thing on DriveThru. Check it out.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll put a link to that as well. Yeah. And Matt also did a great unboxing of the original Moldvay basic box. Yeah, so on the channel. It's really entertaining. And if you've never seen that box, it's well worth it. It's very, very fun, fun piece of gaming history.
Yeah. Oh, that reminds me. This is dumb tangent, but someone sent me a link. There's an action figure of this sorceress. A company makes an action figure of her, so I'm like, I kind of need to have that.
Excellent. Yeah. So we better see that in the background next time on the weekly.
Might be a couple weeks, but
Nice, nice, nice. All right. Excellent. All right. Yeah, so thank you
so
much.
How about you?
Oh, me. Yes, yes. Abuse Cartoons. Yes, so Abuse Cartoons is still a thing. I'm still doing it weekly. It's two single-panel gag cartoons that I draw. And that's on YouTube and Twitch. I do a live stream during the drawing of the cartoons. I also eat some snacks from Japanese convenience stores, so you can see some weird, wacky flavors and things that they have here. And so that's Abuse Cartoons on social media. And if you want to read that cartoon, gocomics.com/domesticabuse is the archive of 20 years of domestic abuse. And if you'd like to support what we're doing here on the weekly, consider becoming a weakling on Patreon. It's patreon.com/upturntable. And you can have kind of direct contact with us. Let us know what you want to see more of on the stream. Send us some news tips and things about stories that sound interesting and kind of like, you know, what we usually cover. And and interact with us. We've got a Discord server for both YouTube members and the Patreon. You can log into Discord and all that good stuff. So Upturntable on social media. And basically that is what we're doing. And then upturntable.com is the website where kind of everything is centered. So over the weekend, I will be finishing the final chapter of Frenzy, the second volume of the Apostle of Insanity trilogy for the Mutant Chronicles. So if you're enjoying that, or if you never heard any of that before, so this is kind of a dead, novel that existed for Mutant Chronicles that is out of print, doesn't really exist anymore, and never had an audiobook. So I just did an audio reading of it so we can enjoy that. This is a follow-up to what I did over the Christmas. Last Christmas, I did the first book. It's kind of an advent calendar because it happened to have 25 chapters. So, second version, and that's going to that'll premiere over the weekend, the 20th chapter, which is the climax of the story. So if you enjoy Mutant Chronicles, that's a fun way to jump into that universe. And that might be a new thing, finding just dead books, dead book audiobooks. Might be a fun thing for the channel to do. So along with the lore series and things we've done for Mutant Chronicles, that's been fun. All right, so
we getting that Dragonbane,
and Dragonbane is coming. That's right. Well, once I pay my import fees, I'll get my Dragonbane too. So Japan decided they're gonna tax us for importing games from Scandinavia, I guess. So we'll see. So I'll have a copy of Dragonbane and unbox that, and I'll post that second episode.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes. And tomorrow night we're doing a live stream of the next the next session of Knave that Matt will be running, and I'll post the audio for the previous sessions in the member audio for both Patreon and YouTube. If you're interested in catching up on that, for as little as a dollar, you can hear what we're up to on our weekly roleplay sessions. So that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.